Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1987, is a conversation with the inventor of the Ames test, Professor Bruce Ames. He's concerned with the exaggeration of the danger of chemical residues in the environment. He urges restraint and common sense. We hope you enjoy his views today and stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
I'm Bruce Ames. I'm chairman of the biochemistry department here at the University of California at Berkeley. And I'm a scientist who's worked in the area of carcinogens, chemicals that cause cancer, mutagens, chemicals that damage the genes, and I've been doing that most of my scientific life. I got my PhD from Caltech in Pasadena and was at the National Institutes of Health for about 15 years and came to Berkeley in 1968. I'm a member of the National Academy of Sciences. I used to be on the board of directors, the National Cancer Advisory Board of the National Cancer Institute, and I've been on many national committees. And so my interest is what's out there that's causing cancer, and also in what's out in the world causing DNA damage and birth defects, and that's what I've spent most of my scientific life on. And recently, I've become more and more concerned because whatever I've been learning is telling me that pollution really is pretty much irrelevant to public health. It might be a little problem here and there, but it's not a very important problem. And the whole country seems to be thinking that pollution is very important. And I'd like to discuss why I think it's not, and why one should be optimistic that life expectancy is getting longer and we're the healthiest we've ever been in human history, and why the one thing you can be sure of is that life expectancy is going to get longer and longer, and that modern technology is enabling us to be healthier and healthier and will continue to do that.
Dr. Ames, right. Where did you start as a scientist? Where did you get your training as a scientist?
Well, I was an undergraduate at Cornell University, and I majored in chemistry and also in biology and genetics. And then I went to Caltech and got my PhD in what would probably be now called molecular biology. It was sort of half biochemistry and half genetics. And then I went on and did a postdoc at the National Institute of Health and stayed on there. I was a section chief, and I've been chairman of the department at Berkeley for a number of years.
What is biochemistry? How should I as a layman understand that?
Well, biochemistry is studying the chemical processes that living cells are made up. So all living cells are really chemical factories, and what biochemists and molecular biologists study is how they work. So the genes can control and have all the information for running a cell and for making sure the organism produces an organism like it, and it can mutate and it can change and it can control all of this. And people are really learning how all that works. And biology is going like a rocket now. People are really starting to understand all these things. So there's going to be enormous impact on public health. And the scientists who are doing that are biologists of various sorts, immunologists and geneticists, and biochemists who are working out all the biochemical pathways.
Did any particular individual or an event in your life influence your decision to work in the area of science?
Oh, my father was a science teacher in New York City school system, and then he later became assistant superintendent of schools in New York, and he was at one point in charge of all the science teaching in the school system. And I always liked to collect snakes when I was smaller, frogs or whatever, and I just was always interested in biology and just sort of naturally went into that field.
You'd tag along with Dad to the laboratory? And
not quite, but anyway, I was always interested in how things work. And and
is that what led you into, was there anything specific that moved you to biochemistry specifically?
Well, I guess I was always interested in genetics and always interested in biochemistry, and somehow I just went into that direction.
There's a lot of concern in being expressed in public debate about the low quality of students in science and the lack of interest in science in colleges on the part of students. Do you find that to be true?
Well, we get very good students at Berkeley. I've always liked to have undergraduate students in my lab. My lab at Berkeley would have about 10 postdoctoral fellows. These are people who've gotten their PhDs in some field of science, and these are people from all over the world write me, and they want to come to my lab because they know of my work. And so I'd have about 10 postdocs, and then three or four graduate students who are getting their PhD in science, and they're first top quality. And the postdocs are marvelous people from all over the world, and I pick the best ones, so they're very good. And then undergraduate students, I always like to have three or four undergraduate students in the lab. And we graduate about 100 students a year at Berkeley, and they're really marvelous kids. They're full of enthusiasm, bright. And so I, at least from what I see, there are lots of good people out there.
Mm-hmm. Which would suggest that that at least some high schools must be doing a reasonably good job.
Well, they may, a lot of the students don't write English very well, but that's so maybe they could study a little more grammar in the course of their high school education. But, and I'm not sure the high schools are doing such a good job, but at least we get lots of good students.
You created the Ames test. Mm-hmm. Would you explain the use of this test? What?
Well, I'm sort of half a geneticist, half a biochemist. My contributions to science have been in the area of how genes get turned on and off and other areas like that. I was in at the beginning of the development of molecular biology. And during the course of all this, while I was at NIH, National Institutes of Health, actually, I was reading all the labels on packages of potato chips and seeing they had passed laws saying that they had to list every ingredient in various foods and things. And I became interested in all these compounds and wondering whether any of them might be mutagens, which are chemicals that damage the genes, and wondering what would happen if something came into the environment that was a strong mutagen that we didn't know about. And so it's sort of as a hobby, not part of my regular research, I started playing around with developing a test system for mutagens, chemicals that damage the genes. And the reason I got into it was I was concerned about man-made chemicals. And I had been mutating bacteria for years and studying how you alter genes by mutation. And that's sort of how I got into it. And what we ended up doing is developing a test system for detecting mutagens using bacteria, because you can put a billion bacteria on a petri plate and have them mutated to start with so they can't grow. And now if you mutate them back to normal, then they can grow and you see a colony and you can count the colonies. So you can work out easy techniques, and I developed a system for detecting mutagens. And in the course of that, I became very interested in the relation of carcinogens to mutagens. And we and other people showed that most carcinogens were really working as mutagens, and we could detect them in our test system, which just took an afternoon. We spent 15 years developing this. Again, it wasn't my full time work, but it was sort of a side project in the lab. And in bacteria, we can be very sophisticated in developing things. So it was a sophisticated test, but very easy to do. And we also had ground up rat liver in the test system, because liver converts chemicals to other chemicals, and we want to make sure we got all the chemicals that would be produced in the human body from a particular chemical. Anyway, this test system was adopted because it was easy to detect potential carcinogens, and every industry in the world started using it, and most government agencies became concerned about it, and there are 3,000 laboratories all over the world using our test system. So,
would you explain to us the difference between a mutagenic activity, if you would, and a carcinogenic activity?
Okay. Well, a carcinogen is a chemical that causes cancer in animals or in people. So if you take 50 rats and load them up with a chemical and feed them every day of a lifetime, and then there's an increase, the 30% of the rats are getting cancer anyway, and now what you're asking is something that'll give 60% of the rats cancer or whatever. And so if that chemical does cause an increase in tumors, then you call it a carcinogen. Or we know that smoking, for example, causes cancer in people, and so cigarette smoke is a carcinogen. Now, a mutagen is a chemical damaging the genes. So the genes in the somatic cell genes and germinal cell genes. Somatic cell is every cell in your body has DNA, the genetic material, and that controls all the metabolism of that cell and determines whether it's a liver cell or a skin cell or whatever. And the germline is your sperm and eggs, and if you make a mutation there, you can have a child with a birth defect of some sort. So a mutation then is something upsetting the genetic material, and a carcinogen is something causing cancer.
And you have found strong relationships between the two.
Right. Yeah. We weren't the only people who contributed to that idea, but we made an important contribution in that.
Well, you and your colleagues here at Berkeley right. have also just devised, if I understand correctly, a standard measurement with which you can compare the relative risk to humans of various cancer-causing chemicals. Would you briefly explain this measurement to us?
Well, that's not a great contribution in the field, I think. But in any case, it's more just systematizing some information that everybody really was dealing with. But what we did do is we took all the animal cancer tests. Most cancer tests are done on rats and mice because they're relatively cheap, though it does end up costing $500,000 to do a cancer test in rats or mice. And human, in terms of people, we know relatively few causes of cancer. We know about cigarette smoking, that's a big one, and alcohol and sunshine and a few other things, and a few industrial chemicals. But they're a fairly short list, maybe 20 or 30 things that are thought to be causing human cancer. But in rats and mice, we can test chemicals at high doses and ask what causes cancer in rats and mice. And the supposition is if something causes cancer in rats and mice at a similar dose, it might cause cancer in people. And all we did is took all the animal cancer tests that have ever been done in rats and mice and put all the information into a computer and did some calculations and calculated what is the dose that is needed to feed these rats and mice every day of their lifetime to give half of them cancer. So it's just a measure of the potency. So it's not a great contribution to the field, but we systematized the whole science literature on animal cancer tests.
Well, this once you've determined this, mm-hmm. you are using it then to, in a certain sense, extrapolate some possible conclusions relative to human risk factors. Is that right?
Well, that gets into the whole question of human risk. Yeah. How do we determine human risk from a number in a rat? And that's an area where there's been a lot of scientific controversy. Basically, we don't know how to do it. We can't. What's reasonable is if compound X causes cancer in rats at a certain dose, fed every day to lifetime is how they do it, that I think it's quite reasonable that kind of dose, and dose is always expressed in milligrams per kilo. That is, one gives the dose per weight of the animal. You give a much smaller dose to a rat than to a person to get the same effect. But if you scale up on milligrams per kilo, most people feel that that's a rough equivalent. So what is reasonable that a similar milligrams per kilo in a rat and a person that every day of the lifetime might give cancer to the human if it does to the rat. What we don't know is whether 1,000th that dose is going to do anything or do 1,000th of the effect or 1,000,000th of the dose. Does that do anything or does it do 1,000,000th of an effect? That's where there's a lot of uncertainty and that's where there's been a lot of scientific controversy. But what I think most people would agree on is that if people are getting a dose approaching the dose that's giving the rats and mice cancer, then one should be very careful about it because that seems to be pretty dangerous.
I assume from that then that in most, if not all, these instances where there is some regulatory effort made regarding a chemical, the human exposure is significantly less than the exposure of the rat or the mouse in the experimental environment.
Oh yeah, that's the problem, because human exposure to man-made chemicals is thousands or millions of times less than the dose that actually gave cancer. And that's where all the disagreement is on whether you really can predict. And I think most of the good people in the field feel we don't know enough to predict the number of people who are going to get cancer from that. Leaving aside all the possible differences in metabolism between rats and people, even if we assume they're just the same, we don't know enough about the theory to know what a small dose should do. And I have my opinions on it, and other people have their opinions, but there's still scientific controversy.
Well, your study, from the on the basis of the research that you did, and applying this standardized comparison, the HERP comparison, you did come to a position where, in your opinion, you felt that the current popular view of the threat of these chemicals is enormously exaggerated. Is that correct?
Right.
Are you the only scientist who holds this view?
Oh, no, I think most toxicologists feel that, but the public opinion isn't influenced by toxicologists particularly.
So, what is it influenced by, in your opinion? Why? Is
well,
it
by what the newspapers print.
And where do they get the information that is contrary to these the research results that you've had?
Well, I think most, for the last 10 years, newspaper articles have been having stories about toxic chemical here and toxic chemical there and pollution and carcinogen in your water. And most of the information tends to come from environmental organizations that have a very, what I would view as extreme view on everything. And I don't think they're getting the general feeling of the scientific community on this. And also the science is changing.
In doing this research, you obviously are influenced by these levels of difference that you've perceived. Can you give us some graphic sense of how much difference there is between the dosage that the
well, so different chemicals have very different potencies. That means you need a lot more of some chemicals to give cancer than other chemicals. Every chemical is tested at the toxic dose. That is, the way people do animal cancer testing is they find out the dose that'll kill the animal and then just do a little less and give it every day of the lifetime. So basically, you're getting to the toxic dose and you give it for the lifetime. And the reason for doing that isn't, people could say, well, that's crazy. Why do people do it that way? There were some good reasons for doing it that way, though they may be giving us partly the wrong answer, and I think partly they are. But I think the reason is that 30% of the rats are getting cancer anyway, just on ordinary lab food. And so that in order to see a statistically significant increase, you need to get as much of the chemical in as you can. And so what people do is try, because they can only afford to do an experiment with 50 rats and 50 controls or 50 mice and 50 controls. It's $500,000 to just do that because of all the expense. And so in the whole world, they're only testing a few hundred chemicals a year to see if they're carcinogen. So what they do is do these very high doses and hope that that result might be applicable at a low dose. Now, originally, the purpose of doing the high doses was to look at high volume industrial chemicals that workers might be getting fairly large doses of and try and identify before workers came down with cancer which chemicals might be causing cancer.
Well, for the person who's not a scientist, would an analogy be that something like that if we had a human being and we put them under great stress, didn't feed them very well, and then exposed them to the cold virus, we could expect that they're much more likely to catch a cold under those circumstances than they would in their normal state.
Well, again,
is that the kind of situation that the testing is akin to?
Well, I wouldn't quite describe it in that way, but in any case, that's the way things are done. The question is, how close to reality is that and what are we learning? And I think in some cases, people actually do get doses that are close to the dose that are giving half the rats and mice cancer. For example, in an occupational setting, ethylene dibromide was one of the main fumigants in the country, and workers were actually breathing in a level of ethylene dibromide that was the same as the level that would give half the rats and mice cancer. Now, they weren't breathing it in their whole lives, and they might just get it a peak here and there, but that was an allowable level. And that seemed just unreasonable because they were just getting much too much based on what we know in rats and mice. And so that the purpose of doing high-dose tests was partly to weed out these chemicals in occupation where we might be getting giving the workers too much. But the question is, does it mean anything at low doses? And the other thing is, one has to know what human exposure is relative to the dose that does something in a rat. And that's where I can, I'll give you an illustration. So if you take a series of different carcinogens, and I'll start with alcohol. Now, one can say alcohol is a carcinogen. I didn't know alcohol was a carcinogen. But in fact, there's pretty good human evidence, in fact, very good human evidence that alcohol is a carcinogen. People have done all kinds of epidemiological studies showing that alcoholic beverages increases the risk of liver cancer from cirrhosis of the liver, esophageal cancer, cancer of the mouth. Now there's results coming out on alcohol and breast cancer. And alcohol does give cancer to rats, and acetaldehyde, the main metabolite of alcohol, is a carcinogen. Okay. But again, the question is the dose. Well, alcohol, you have to give an enormous dose to give the rats cancer. In fact, when you feed them at the maximum tolerated dose, you're feeding a high dose. So it's 10,000 milligrams per kilo per day, fed every day, a lifetime, to give half the rats cancer. This is the amount, just rounded off, to give half the rats cancer, and all in milligrams per kilo, just to give you a comparison. So trichloroethylene, which is the main chlorinated solvent in the country, you have to feed 1,000 milligrams per kilo to give half the rats and mice cancer. So that means trichloroethylene is 10 times more potent than alcohol. And then chloroform, which isn't present in all water from chlorinating the water, is 100 milligrams per kilo. So it's 10 times more potent than trichloroethylene. And DDT is 10, which is 10 times more potent than chloroform. And formaldehyde, which is present when you bake bread and present in all sorts of things, is 1, which is about 10 times more potent than DDT. And then to get really potent, something that's really potent, aflatoxin, which is a mold carcinogen, a mold, Aspergillus flavus, which is a common mold, makes aflatoxin. So there's always a little bit in peanut butter or other moldy food. And that's 0.001, which means it's 1,000 times more potent than formaldehyde, 1,000,000 times more potent than trichloroethylene, and 10 million times more potent than alcohol. So you look at this list and you say, ah, we should avoid aflatoxin, alcohol isn't something to worry about. Well, that's not the answer, because what you want to know is not only how strong it is, but how much we're getting relative to its potency. So if we're not, if we're getting extremely tiny amounts of aflatoxin, even though it's very potent, we maybe not don't have to worry about it. And if we're getting large amounts of alcohol relative to this amount, then maybe we do want to worry. And I think, in fact, that's the answer. That is, if you ask how much alcohol is in a beer, we're getting fairly close to the toxic level of alcohol. And the same thing is true with birth defects. Those are done, chemicals causing birth defects are done at the maximum tolerated dose, and alcohol is a known substance causing birth defects in people, and it also causes birth defects in mice. And again, if you ask it what dose it's doing, it's some very high dose, but there's so much alcohol in a drink that we're getting close to this kind of high dose. So, and then you can ask about trichloroethylene, chloroform, and DDT, and formaldehyde, and all these other things. So what we did is we took all these numbers on how potent the chemical is, and then asked how does the human exposure relate to the potency, and get a percentage. So if humans were getting 100% of the dose on a milligram per kilo basis to give half the rats cancer, we'll call that 100. That's our HERP number. And then if humans are only getting 1%, we'll call it 1. And if they're getting 0.001%, we'll call it 0.001. And that gives a way of comparing different substances. In each case, you're asking how close is it to the dose where it really does something.
Did you have anything that came close to 100?
Oh, yeah. Some cases of occupational exposure, in fact, the workers were getting close to if not even the same level as the level that we're giving half the rats and mice cancer.
You seem to be at this point suggesting that I, as a layman, should apply some common sense to this data, and that you, in effect, are doing so. You mentioned the EDB, right. And if I understood correctly, you were saying that in a occupational sense, this could truly be a problem. And yet, in its wide use throughout the country, it was not a problem.
Yeah. In fact, I think just that. I testified in California that the level that workers were allowed to get in was completely unreasonable. And California, in fact, lowered the standard over 100-fold and got down to a much more reasonable level, but then on a national level, they never did anything. So then again, if you look at all of these things and ask, well, what seems of interest, there's nothing that comes even close to alcohol when you look at the amounts. So if you put things in beer equivalents, all this pollution seems to fade away as being something one's very concerned with. And I think that for various reasons that I'd be willing to talk about. The other thing is people have the idea that carcinogens are rare, they're mostly man-made, and we can get rid of them. And that's not true, because 99.99% of the chemicals in the world are natural, and natural chemicals, if you ask are what percentage of man-made chemicals are coming out as carcinogens, what percentage of natural chemicals, it's about half for either one. That is, half the chemicals they've ever tested have come out as carcinogens among the natural group and about half for the man-made chemicals. So it's not that very different if you take the ordinary metals that have been around since all of evolution, a high percentage of those are coming out as carcinogens, or mold toxins, a high percentage of those are coming out as carcinogens. So it's carcinogen. So I think most of the carcinogen in the world are going to be natural, and the natural substances, we're much closer to this toxic level than we are for the man-made things. And so we're just not getting enough pollution in to make a difference when you compare it to the whole, because every meal you eat is full of carcinogens. And it doesn't mean that that's necessarily causing all the human cancer. You have to then ask what's significant and what is the dose response curve look like?
You seem to suggest that, and perhaps you do suggest, that cancer is an aging illness. It's maybe a natural part of cell life.
It is. Cancer goes up very sharply with age. If you take a rat. Sorry, scientists are used to drawing things on graphs. But if you plot age of the animal versus cancer and look at rats, cancer goes up something like that. So rats live about 2 years, and by the end of the 2 years, 30% of them have cancer, just on ordinary food, not adding any carcinogen. And people also get cancer with about the fourth power of age, except we live to our 80s. In fact, life expectancy is getting longer and longer, which means, so about 30% of us get cancer when we're in our 70s and 80s, by that age. Okay. So that means that rats are enormously more susceptible to cancer than people. They're getting cancer by age 2. And so all of this is under evolutionary control, and I think it's one aspect of aging. That is, whatever's doing us in for aging, and that's, in fact, my main research area, it's also doing us in for cancer. But that doesn't mean that some of it isn't due to external causes as well, but its underlying cancer is that it's part of the aging process.
Back to the details of your work for a minute. The report that you've released on these comparisons was the result of laboratory research and on rats, etc. You mentioned, though, epidemiological studies. What is that? What's epidemiology?
Well, epidemiologists are people, usually with a mathematical background or medical background, who study cause associations. That is, if epidemiologists pin down that smoking causes lung cancer, they can study thousands of people who smoke, thousands of people who don't smoke. What they find is there's a lot of lung cancer in the people who smoke. There's practically no lung cancer in the people who don't smoke. They can ask how many cigarettes they smoke per day and make a plot of number of cigarettes versus amount of lung cancer and do studies like that that then leads them to conclude, yes, smoking is causing lung cancer. And then they conclude that 30% of the cancer in the United States is due to cigarettes. And 25% of the heart disease as well. So 2 packs a day is about 8 years off your life. So epidemiologists are people who study real human diseases and try and get at the cause by studying associations. And they've come to various conclusions about human cancer. And they're studying the real human cancers that we're suffering from.
Can you give us a specific example of an epidemiological study that supports your conclusions, for example?
Well, there have been a number of many good epidemiologists studying cause of cancer. The general conclusion they've come to is that, one, the only type of cancer that seems to be significantly increasing is lung cancer, and that is overwhelmingly due to smoking. So all the conclusions say that. And the only other type of cancer that is clearly going up is melanomas and skin cancer, and that's thought to be due to sunshine. The evidence is pretty good about that. So that fair-skinned people are just going to the beach too much. So aside from that, it's what's also clear is stomach cancer has been coming down for 50 years, liver cancer has been coming down for 50 years, uterine cancer has been coming down. So people make conclusions about different types of cancer, and the main cancers now are breast cancer and colon cancer and prostate cancer, and they haven't really been changing very much for 50 years. The other conclusion they've come to is that some types of cancer differ very much from group to group or country to country. For example, Japan has one of the highest rates of stomach cancer in the world. America has one of the lowest rates. Conclusion, there's some difference between Japanese and Americans. So then they studied Japanese immigrants to California, and their stomach cancer rate becomes like Americans. So conclusion is something in the lifestyle of Japanese that causes stomach cancer that's not in the lifestyle of Americans. The other thing is colon and breast cancer are very high in the United States and very low in Japan. And you can also then ask what happens to Japanese immigrants to California, and their colon and breast cancer rate goes up. So again, epidemiologists have done that kind of study and concluded that a good part of cancer might be preventable, in the sense if we could figure out why the Japanese have a low colon and breast cancer rate and why we have a low stomach cancer rate, maybe we can get at the causes or preventing factors or whatever it is to do with these different types of cancer. And none of the clues were pointing to modern chemicals as being a significant factor in all of this. So Dahl and Pito, who are two of the most eminent epidemiologists in the world, did a big book on causes of cancer, and pollution seemed to be a very minor factor. Again, it doesn't mean that you want to keep on polluting everything, but it just didn't seem to be credible as a cause, a significant cause of cancer. And my numbers from looking at what the chemicals are out there that might be carcinogens, I also come to the conclusion that pollution is not likely to be a significant cause of cancer. The numbers just don't add up.
Yeah, from an epidemiological point of view, can you give us some example as to what kind of evidence was there that industrialization, for example, wasn't a cause of cancer?
Well, it's just that if you ask what might be causing colon cancer and look at the difference between Japanese and Americans, and industrialization didn't seem to be a credible cause of it, because colon cancer has been the same for 50 years in the United States, and it's always been high. And so industrialization, a modern chemical world, came in after that. So it doesn't, that isn't something that could have caused this high rate of colon cancer.
Moving to a country that has very little industry then is not a protection against cancer.
No, people are dying in an early, now cancer, since cancer goes up so sharply with age, you always have to correct for age, because people who are dying at age 20 never have a chance to get cancer. So the longer live country is going to have more total cancer, but if you ask cancer among a group of 50-year-olds, so epidemiologists always age correct. They correct for the age group because the total amount of cancer goes up with age because it's related to aging.
Going back to the specific details here, and that particular fact that you point out leads to this interesting observation that the blessing of old age carries the curse of cancer. That's one way.
Yeah, well, everything goes down with age. I mean, your heart doesn't work as well. Your blood vessels get clogged up. Your muscles aren't as strong. Your immune system. So we know that all of biology is degenerating with age, and one of the things, and you have defenses against cancer, and that's degenerating too. So cancer goes up with age as well.
It's a very complex problem then, because you've cited lifestyle, environment, aging, cellular changes in cells, etc. And that says, therefore, that any suggestion that there's a simple answer to cancer, should we be questioning that?
Yeah, no, cancer is many, there are going to be many different, the Japanese are figuring out possible clues as to the causes of stomach cancer. And it may have to do with high salt in the Japanese diet, not enough vitamin C, and various combinations of things. Cancer is mostly multi-causal. People have figured out what's causing liver cancer. Liver cancer is very low in the United States, though it used to be higher in past generations. And liver cancer is very high in China and Africa. Well, people for a while thought that the main cause was aflatoxin, this chemical that's made by molds, and mold pollution is very high in tropical countries. And so aflatoxin is so potent, and there's a lot of it in food, because they don't have good refrigeration, and it's warm and humid. So they thought, maybe aflatoxin is causing liver cancer. But then people found that that aflatoxin doesn't seem to be enough. And then they found that hepatitis B virus is endemic in Africa and China, and that's wrecking your liver all the time. And it looks like it's a combination of aflatoxin, which is mutating the cells, and hepatitis B virus, which is wrecking your liver. And hepatitis B seems to be the major factor, actually, in liver cancer. So people are finding out clues as the cause of cancer, and I think that's going to come at a faster and faster rate. So we're going to figure out the cause of colon cancer, figure out the causes of breast cancer. They already know a number of the risk factors for breast cancer. It has to do with hormones and the age you have your first child and other things like that.
In your study, going back to the beer, which is of interest to a lot of people in the United States, the figures you use suggest that a glass of beer might pose a risk 1,000 times greater than a quart of water from the California water wells that were contaminated and declared.
Yeah, so that's the kind of thing I started asking. Well, how much? All water has carcinogens. That is, when you chlorinate your water, you make some chloroform. And so chloroform is here on the scale, so you can ask, well, how does the average chlorinated water in the U.S. compare to the level to give the rats cancer? And I came out with a number 0.001. That means we're 1/1000th of a percent of the level to give the rats cancer. So, or well, actually, 100 would be 100%, and this is 0.001. So it's a very tiny amount. So there's a little bit of carcinogen in all the water, and whether it's dangerous or not at all depends on what the shape of that dose response curve is. Do we really know whether a small dose is as serious proportionally as a large dose? And I think it's probably not, but that we can discuss that later. So then if you ask, well, what about the alcohol in a beer compared to the level of a beer, it can be drinking. If you just do simple-minded calculations on this, you could say that drinking a quart of water every day of your lifetime is the equivalent of drinking a beer every 10 years. Okay, so that's how the numbers come out, which means that obviously alcohol is enormously more significant than anything you're getting from water, because it's so much closer to the level that's actually doing something. Now, do we really want to worry about a beer a day? And that question is still out. I would have said, up to fairly recently, probably not, because I think it's going to fall off very sharply with dose. But recently, there's some evidence that even perhaps a beer a day might increase the risk of breast cancer for women. And there's starting to be pretty good evidence that that might be true. But that has to be, epidemiologists have to work that out and make sure that it's not some other factor that's doing it. But at least evidence that's reasonably strong is coming out on that. But now, whether it's drinking 4 beers on a Saturday during one critical phase of breast development rather than a little bit every day, we don't know the answer to that yet. But in any case, it's enormously more than anything you get from pollution. Most of the polluted wells are safer than tap water. That is, if you look, ask Woburn, Massachusetts, they found a few chemicals in the well water, but if you do the numbers, that water was safer to drink than ordinary tap water because tap water has a little chloroform in it. And if you ask the wells in Silicon Valley, they shut down 35 wells, 33 of them were safer than tap water. And even the worst well was way under a peanut butter sandwich because there's always a little aflatoxin in peanut butter. So the minute you start comparing these man-made things in terms of pollution, again, not occupation, in terms of pollution, the minute you start comparing them to the background level of carcinogens, they seem awfully small. And one of my contributions was to point out that there are carcinogens everywhere. For example, pesticides. How much pesticide residues do we get? Well, we get 150 micrograms of pesticide residues a day, roughly. Food and Drug adds all these things up and looks, analyzes all the major pesticides on food. And that's a pretty small amount because there are a few thousand micrograms of known carcinogens in a cup of coffee. And so a microgram is an awfully tiny amount, and you make carcinogens when you cook your food. So every time you cook your food, you're making all kinds of carcinogens on the outside of your hamburger. And plants have all kinds of carcinogens. And when you start comparing things, these things start looking very small. But what people haven't been doing is they haven't been comparing. They've been taking a number for one particular chemical, doing all these worst case assumptions, and then calculating how many dead babies there are going to be in the country. But they never, if they do the same thing on a beer a day is causing all the cancer in the country, if you do these worst case assumptions. And that's obviously not true. And we don't really even know whether a beer a day is any risk at all. So it's all complicated. One of the things I looked at was, in terms of pesticides, the numbers seemed awfully small to me. And then I started thinking about nature's pesticides. See, people don't often think about this, but every plant has its own pesticides. And these I call nature's pesticides. And these are toxic chemicals the plant makes to kill off the insects and the predators that would be eating the plant. So all of plant evolution is based on plants making new and nastier toxic chemicals. And hundreds of thousands of these have been described by scientists with all sorts of weird chemical structures. And every plant is somewhere from 5 or 10% of its weight in a mixture of these chemicals. Each plant has different ones, but they're incredible variety of these things. So potatoes have solanine and chaconine, and tomatoes have tomatine, and Brussels sprouts have a whole variety of indoles. And these are nature's pesticides. And I calculated we're eating 10,000 times more of these than we are of man-made pesticide residues. Not 10 times, not 100 times, not 1,000 times, but 10,000 times more. So then one can ask, well, what toxicology has been done on these things? Because the whole human diet is completely different than it was 1,000 years ago. The potato came from the New World, the tomato came from the New World, the kiwi fruits came in the other day. So primitive man ate a completely different diet. So one could ask, well, what about all these things? Could they be carcinogens? And in fact, very few of them have been tested, but of those that have been tested, they're finding just about as high a percentage of carcinogen as among man-made chemicals, or at least a reasonably high percentage. So mustard has a carcinogen, celery has a carcinogen, parsley has a carcinogen, pepper has a carcinogen, mushrooms are full of carcinogen. So the minute you look around, you find all these things, and then and we're eating enormously more of these other things than we are of the man-made things. So it just never made sense to me that pesticide residues are going to be important. Either absolutely the amount is very tiny, or particularly when you compare it to all the other carcinogens around. Plus, we make carcinogen when we cook our food, and as I say, alcohol is a carcinogen. So then you have to ask, well, what's important out of all of this? And that's the key thing on all of this. Is if you spend all your time on trivia, you're lost. Because you have to decide what looks important, and alcohol looks important, so you put a red warning flag on it for Tourette, for birth defects. Women who are pregnant probably shouldn't drink very much. And then you also want to do epidemiology on it to study what is the effect on people, because the numbers come out pretty high in rat when you compare it to the dose to give cancer to the rat. But the minute you start looking at chloroform in water or these polluted wells, it's just very tiny.
Well, why are those things attractive and attract government regulations, and the things you're mentioning are never dealt with?
Well, the field just kind of, we knew that workers could get cancer from waiting around in beta-naphthalamine or aminobiphenyl. And so we knew that a high dose of a particular chemical could give cancer to workers. And those same chemicals gave cancer to rats. Aha, that chemical can give cancer. And then people kind of made the funny jump to say, yes, maybe that's causing a lot of cancer in the world. But that didn't make sense from the point of view of the epidemiologist, because that wasn't the conclusion they had been coming to. But some people got that idea and said, we have to root out every possible carcinogen. But what they forget is that the world is full of carcinogens. Sunshine is a carcinogen. We know that ultraviolet light causes cancer. But you don't want to put up an umbrella every time you cross the street because you poke somebody's eyes out or you don't see a car coming. I mean, you can't avoid all sun just because it has a small increased risk of cancer. So you have to have some common sense about it. And there are always trade-offs on the other side. The chlorinated solvents replace flammable solvents. We can't go back to using flammable solvents for doing our dry cleaning or for industry. Industry can't exist without these chlorinated solvents. The metal degreasers, Silicon Valley has to use chlorinated solvents. So does a lot of industry. You don't get 1 billion pounds of some chemical without it having really significant economic uses. And flammable solvents are way too dangerous. And so the question is, and the price you pay for this is a little bit of pollution. I mean, and you can make a car that emits no pollution, but it's very expensive and enormously expensive. And that means ambulances get more expensive, transportation, you have to walk places and with the danger, walk through snowstorms or if you don't have cars. I mean, there are all kinds of complicated economic trade-offs. And the question is air pollution important? Obviously, in a place like Los Angeles, you want to crack down. But where do you end? If you try and get rid of every last little bit, it's a recipe for disaster. And besides, there's so many carcinogens around when you test them at the maximum tolerated dose that you have to decide what's important and push there. And the whole world of natural chemicals has been barely scratched. And we're much closer to the toxic level for all those things than we are for man-made things. Plus, plant breeders now are breeding plants to be insect resistant. All they're doing is raising the level of all these natural things. So we may be much worse off.
In a sense, then, we should be encouraged by your results, not discouraged. Encouraged in the sense that even though we now know that beer has this problem, that it looks as if maybe we have a great tolerance to some of these.
Well, animals are designed to deal with carcinogens. The whole lining of our digestive system is thrown away every day. All those cells lining our digestive system or all our skin cells are thrown away. Because even if they get mutated, you throw the cells away. So an animal is designed to handle carcinogens because it's been handling carcinogen evolution. But there are general mechanisms for handling carcinogen. So our liver is full of detoxifying enzymes. And we make carcinogens in our normal metabolism. When fat goes rancid, you get a whole mess of carcinogens. And in fact, I think that may be the main mutagens and carcinogens that contribute to aging, all these oxidative processes that go on in normal metabolism. But that's another matter. So it's all very complicated, and they're anti-carcinogens. And so the one thing, though, that's clear is that we're the healthiest we've ever been in human history. I mean, there's no increase in birth defects as far as anybody can see. Cancer has been pretty steady except for the cancer due to smoking. And life expectancy, which is the final measure of our health, is getting longer and longer. People are living to their 80s now. In fact, if people weren't smoking, life expectancy would be in the 80s. It's incredible. And Japan, which is a very crowded, industrialized country, is one of the longest life expectancies in the world. So modern technology is producing health. And the one thing you can be sure of is Social Security is going to go broke, because every projection was the curve is going up like that in terms of life expectancy. And every projection's been wrong because they've never extrapolated the curve. And modern biology is going so fast, and modern technology is giving us all these tools that people are going to figure out the cause of heart disease. And people will live longer because they will have less heart disease. And people will figure out just the way tuberculosis isn't a problem anymore. And bacterial diseases from polluted water aren't a problem anymore. We chlorinate the water. Now, we get a little carcinogen from that, but it's a trivial amount. And we got rid of all those bacterial diseases. So there are all these trade-offs, and we keep on pushing everything back, and it's going to continue to go at a faster and faster rate because biology, science is going so fast.
You, as a result of your research, though, are now being accused of siding with American business, that you're now on the side of the businessman who really doesn't want to spend the money to avoid pollution.
Well, it's a question, in some sense, I think business has gotten industry has gotten a bad deal, bad name out of all of this. I mean, industry is creating the wealth of the country. I'm not a socialist that thinks that if somebody makes a profit, it's a bad thing. I mean, but you have to ask, you do want rules. You don't want every chemical company dumping the garbage out the back door, but the rules have to have some relation to public health. And there are also incentives for businessmen not to poison their customers. I mean, that isn't good for business. So, incidentally, I made it a policy not to make any money out of my scientific research in this area. So I don't do any consulting for industry, and I don't consult for lawyers. And so I just kept myself clean on all of it. But I do feel that industry's gotten a bad name out of all of this, because they're making the products that are creating the wealth and providing the trichloroethylenes that increase the wealth of the society, and the perchloroethylenes that you can use for dry cleaning instead of flammable solvents. So industry, the reason the United States is healthy is partly because it's wealthy. I mean, wealth and health are related, and we're wealthy because of what industry is creating. It doesn't mean, again, that you don't want to put rules where they're needed, but it's a question, how much do you want to spend and what's important to do? And I think the key thing over and over again is deciding what's important. And so I think you need to tell people that smoking is 30% of U.S. cancer and 25% of U.S. heart disease, and yet the government spends as much money subsidizing tobacco farmers as they do for cancer research. Okay, that's another matter. But whatever you do, you have to say what's important. You shouldn't be eating too much saturated fat in your diet. That's bad for heart disease. You don't want to overdo the sunshine. And there are relatively few things that we know about, but we're learning more and more. So the information comes in, it's a little fuzzy. Some of the things turn out not to be true, some turn out to be true, but it's all progressing.
We have information now sufficient enough to respond to the argument, well, wouldn't we be better off safe than sorry? Is that what you're saying?
Well, so the question is, one argument that's often used is, let's be prudent. We don't know, let's be prudent. But at what point does prudence become perilous? I mean, the question is, you could stop every car because it's emitting pollution, or you could not put logs on your fire because you're putting carcinogens up. You not fry your hamburgers, but the consequences of all these things. And so you're not prudent. If your kid goes off to summer camp and you give him a list of 500 things he should watch out for, you're not being prudent. You tell him the four or five things that are important, and you forget about the rest. I mean, you can't spend all your time on trivia. And it isn't that these things don't have enormous economic consequences, because things don't get to be, pesticides are useful in agriculture. If you don't use man-made pesticides, you're going to be breeding plants that have more of nature's pesticides. We're getting those in much higher amounts, and we know very little about that. And I think we'll be worse off. And vegetables are good for you, not bad for you. So you have to take into, it's very complicated. And if you try and prevent cancer at 10 to the minus 6 lifetime theoretical worst-case risk, which is what people sometimes now are doing, I think you just make things worse. For example, EPA just passed a new rule that they allow 5 micrograms per liter of trichloroethylene in water. Well, I calculate if you drink a liter of that water every day of your lifetime, it's the equivalent to drinking a beer every 10,000 years. So you can laugh at that, but that's the level we've reached in paranoia about man-made chemicals.
Well, what do we do then?
Well, I think partly it's just...
What policy changes should we make?
Well, partly it's the reason because of all this confusion is because the science has been murky. But fanatics out there going for the most apocalyptic view of everything don't help clearing up the science. I think scientists have to argue out what's likely to be true and what's not. But partly, we don't know enough to regulate at these very minor hypothetical risks. You have to decide what's important and tell people about what's important and slowly work to try and identify things. We suddenly learn that there's radon coming out of the ground and that that's a major source of radioactivity in the country, which we just learned. Then you quickly do something about radon. If you learn something about saturated fat is bad, then you publicize about saturated fat. But you have to decide what's important, and you can't be prudent about everything, because then you just sit in the dark in a closet and don't do anything. I mean, every time you drive a car, it's 1 in a million risk of death for driving a few miles. Or you cross the street, you're getting a little sunshine, which is a carcinogen. You cook your food, you're getting some carcinogen. You can sit in the house and worry all the time, and that's that isn't a life. That's the most dangerous thing you can do.
Doesn't this issue really create a kind of a new challenge for the scientist? Doesn't it put the scientist in the position of having to come forward in the public policy arena where they're uncomfortable?
Well, it is very uncomfortable. I'm much happier in my lab trying to figure out the cause of aging, which is what I'm interested in, get all excited about. And I don't want to get in the trenches and fight environmentalists, but I just think they're giving a message that isn't true, that it isn't that pollution has much to do with public health. The numbers don't fit. And I think that if we really want to get an idea of the carcinogen world, we should test a lot more natural things, and then you'll find just as many carcinogens. But again, you have to decide what's important, and the ways of doing that, you try and see how close are you to the toxic dose of all sorts of things, and what are we getting in large amounts, and we'll test on that. It's a completely different way of looking at it. But again, there's a lot of progress. People are figuring out how to measure DNA adducts in humans, and I think the one thing one can be absolutely certain of is there's so much progress that we're going to figure out all these things soon, and life expectancy is going to get longer.
So we should be optimistic.
Absolutely. Now, you ruin the economy, that's might change it, or if AIDS spreads around. I mean, AIDS is obviously an area of high priority. You put research into that. And
we should be pleased then with the wealth-creating potential of our industrial...
Absolutely. You go to a third world country and you see that people are dying. People dream of this ideal world back in 1900 or whatever, but people were dying at age 40 and the streets were full of horse manure, and it wasn't such a great life. I mean, we have such a marvelous life now, and we're so healthy and wealthy that's process going to continue.
Has Dr. Ames changed his lifestyle in any way based on this research?
Not really too much. The main thing is eat a good balanced diet, lots of green vegetables, that's good for you, and not too much saturated fat, so I cut the fat. I don't eat as much butter as I used to and cut off the fat from my meat. And eat a lot of fish, which is good for you. And I don't drink too much, never did. Don't smoke, never did. So otherwise, I just work in my lab and try and understand things.